Hey, it's Doug, and welcome to the Crew of Japan podcast, where we take you on audio journeys through Japanese culture. Welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is part one of a two-part episode series, where we had the opportunity to sit down with comedian and Japanese language YouTuber, Dogen. You may have heard of him. If not, you'll know him after this episode for sure. In part one, Daiichi Episodo, Dogen shares what comes first to his mind when he thinks of New Orleans.
When I was in high school, one of my close friends got really into cooking, and his favorite dish that he always made was this kind of Cajun shrimp.
What led to his initial interest in Japan?
When I saw like anime, or when I listened to like Japanese music for the first time, it felt so much different and yet also so rich. For me in particular, the main thing was actually martial arts.
And the moment he realized that he had an audience on YouTube.
What happened is I woke up one day and I had like 1,000 more subscribers than the previous day. And I was like, what's going on? So I went over to Twitter, and this was at a point where I had like 500, 600, maybe 1,000 followers on Twitter. And they said, someone shared one of your videos in the Learn Japanese Reddit.
We cover all that and much more in this episode. Hajime mashou ka. Let's dive on in. All right. Welcome back to the Crew of Japan podcast. This is Doug, and I have with us today Jennifer and Nigel. Say hey, guys.
Hey.
What's up?
And we have with us today a very, very special guest joining us all the way from Japan. Some of our listeners may be familiar with some of his content. Some of you may be on his Patreon. We'll find out, I guess, in our comments section after the on social media. But without further ado, I wanted to introduce our guest today. Very world famous, popular YouTuber. Dogen. Hey, Dogen.
Hey, everyone. Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. I know it's morning time.
Yes.
Where you're at. We're cutting towards the end of the day.
I have better things to say in the morning than at night, so I appreciate it.
as a parent, I completely understand. Yeah. My brain is drained by the end of like 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So again, thank you again for joining us today for our podcast, and we're gonna start it off with getting to know you just a little bit. One of the main topics or questions we ask a lot of our guests when they come onto the podcast, since we are a New Orleans based podcast sponsored by the Japan Society of New Orleans, we ask a lot of our guests to share their connection to the city of New Orleans, if they have mm-hmm. one, you know, whether or not you've been before, if you have, what's your fondest memory. Or if you haven't, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear New Orleans?
Right. So I unfortunately have not been before. And the closest kind of connection that I have is when I was in high school, one of my close friends got really into cooking. And the dish that his favorite dish that he always made was this kind of Cajun shrimp.
Oh, nice.
And I got really into that too. And like every time maybe not every time we met up, but I want to say like maybe every other time we met up, we would make a batch of that and then end up playing like video games for a few hours or something. But that was always like the highlight. So
nice.
Again, I don't have too much of a connection, but that was such an amazing meal. And that's kind of like the image that I have of New Orleans. Really good, I would say, rich culture in terms of both food culture, music culture, and
it's just different.
Yeah.
I would say yeah. Those are probably the two main two that come to my mind. But it's from someone who is essentially just brought up completely in the Pacific Northwest, it feels like a very different and very vibrant place. It, in that sense, kind of has like that kind of different and magical kind of feel that Japan had to me when I was young as well. You know, very different, but also very, very, not what would you say, idiosyncratic, but just very, very, again, it's got its own real unique culture. So that's kind of the unique image that I have of New Orleans.
Well, you know, Tennessee Williams has that famous quote, there are only three cities in America, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. And the rest are just Cleveland.
You know, so. That makes sense. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was in one of the Clevelands, yeah.
Sorry to all our Cleveland listeners out there.
I know.
I love you.
Yikes.
Cut that, Nigel.
I know. We might have lost some viewers there. Well, you know, so I'm really interested in learning more about your Japan journey.
Okay.
Obviously, you know, your videos and your YouTube is based on Japanese language. and Japan. But what actually led to your interest in Japan and eventually studying Japanese and living there?
Great question. I think that, again, kind of going back to what we were talking about a second ago, I was brought up in one of the Clevelands. So that was kind of the culture that I knew. And it was great. I had a very, very nice upbringing. And it was wonderful. But at the same time, that was the only kind of thing that I knew. And in that sense, I think very similar to a lot of other people, when I saw like anime or when I listened to like Japanese music for the first time, it felt so much different and yet also so rich and so interesting. And it was kind of the same way for me in particular. The main thing was actually martial arts. So I was one of the Cleveland kids, so to speak. So I was raised doing basketball, baseball, and soccer, you know, very, very typical suburban American upbringing, so to speak. But something about martial arts felt just so different and so interesting to me. Now, because my dad was actually one of the teachers for our basketball team, I wasn't able to really get out of that circle, so to speak. I needed to be on that team and to do the other sports as well, as many of my other friends' dads were also kind of like the coaches. Yeah, the coaches on like the soccer teams or the baseball teams as well. But I always wanted to do, you know, martial arts or something like that, but I never had the opportunity. And that was always kind of in the back of my mind. But then when the movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Chinese movie, but when that came out, I want to say, I don't know, 2002, maybe somewhere around there. I believe it was early high school for me. Maybe, yeah, probably around there.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I think that, yeah, I was in high school when I saw it too. So yeah, yeah, it was around 2000 to 2003, somewhere in that area.
Yeah. That kind of like cemented it for me. It was like, oh my God, this is so incredible. Like that opening sequence with like the, I'm not sure for the name of the Chinese instrument, but kind of like the taiko drum, kind of sounding drums, and then they're kind of like flying over the rooftops and, you know, doing like the battle, the martial arts battle. And I was like, I have to learn this, even if I'm not allowed to like go to like a, you know, like a proper dojo or whatever. So I actually got really into this. I don't know if a sport is the right way to describe it, but this thing called martial arts tricking, which is a kind of combination of the acrobatic moves in martial arts and also gymnastics and also breakdancing.
Okay.
And that just to me seemed like the coolest thing ever. And I was kind of, this was way before YouTube. So there was kind of two groups of martial arts tricksters. There was the people that had proper upbringings in the dojo and then the backyard tricksters like myself. Who we just had to learn everything by ourselves on the internet. And for basically from the time that I started doing that kind of by myself, self-taught, that was kind of like my life for a considerable amount of time, probably certainly throughout high school. But that was kind of the main catalyst that drove me into, that got me much more interested in Asian culture specifically. And I got more into like Asian music, specifically Japanese music. I had a cousin that listened to a lot of Japanese music, Ayumi Hamasaki. and then I kind of found some bands that really, really resonated with me. And then as I was tricking, like during the day, what I would do is I would listen to the Japanese music like at night. And then I would study. I started studying Japanese by myself as well. When I was around like 14, 15. Yeah. And then I just kind of kept on doing that, kind of switched between like my main passions being Japanese and martial arts tricking for a little bit. But eventually I realized that I didn't have enough talent to make it full time as a martial arts trickster, so to speak. And I was getting a lot of injuries. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to lean into the Japanese thing then. I majored in Japanese in university. And because I'm sure we'll cover this later, maybe just best to cover it now. But when I was in university studying Japanese, another class that I took was a linguistics class. And in that class, there was a session. I'm not sure the correct English word, but one of the topics that we covered was pitch accent and how there are stress accent languages and pitch accent languages. And then there are like tonal languages. And I was taking like a Japanese 101 course at university, and I was trying to sound as native as possible. But then in this separate linguistics class, the professor was like, oh yeah, so Japanese is one of the pitch accent languages. And I was kind of like, wait, what? Like, excuse me, pitch accent? I've never heard that word. No one's ever mentioned that before. And my teacher didn't really know how to teach it also. So I kind of did my own little research, picking up books like, obviously, you can't see this if you're listening to the podcast, but like the NHK Accent Dictionary, books like this, and learning more about pitch accent and kind of, well, Japanese pronunciation specifically in detail. And that was kind of my main thing for a while as well. I took a one-year study abroad at Keio University in Tokyo. I came back, and then I kind of had another... what would you say, life-changing experience. I was in a contemporary Japanese literature course, one of my classes at university when I got back from Japan. And we read this short story called Mink by this author named Kanehara Hitomi. And it just completely blew my mind. It's kind of like Fight Club in the sense that the protagonist is not schizophrenic isn't the right word, but they kind of have like a split personality. And what would happen in the book is you would read like two pages, and then at the end of like every other two pages, it would say, and everything that I just described was actually like in my mind, and this is what's actually happening.
Oh wow.
And it was cool.
Yeah.
And it's kind of trippy.
Yeah. And it was so creative, and it just like blew my mind. And I think probably precisely because I had been so into like the martial arts thing for so long, and I hadn't been exposed to like a lot of good like literature, and I would say maybe like proper art, so to speak. I was doing just the martial arts thing in Japanese. And so I wasn't watching like a lot of great movies. I wasn't reading like a lot of great books. I was just doing the tricking thing and studying Japanese. But so when I got back and I read this book, this short story, I was like, this is incredible. Like, I need to learn how to do this now, like how to write. And I took a bunch of courses on creative writing in my last year at university. And the thing that kept coming up from my professors is they would say, you're trying too hard when you're trying to come off seriously. We can kind of tell that you're not a very well-read person. But when you write in, like, when you do comedy, because we had a couple assignments where it was like, try and write this, like this prompt, but from like a comedic perspective, so to speak. Do this in comedy. They would always say, you might be good at this. If you really want to pursue this writing thing, go for comedy, because you might be able to do this. You're trying too hard with the other stuff, and it's clear that that's not going to happen. And so I kind of just rolled with it, so to speak. And I came to Japan on the JET program, and I tried writing a few short stories in Japanese. I used this site called Language 8 to get like a lot of corrections from native speakers and get feedback on my written Japanese. And at the end of my 3 years on the JET program, I essentially, that entire time, I was in most of the free time that I had, I dedicated to creative writing in Japanese and trying to improve, so to speak. And then the kind of big, I think I said epiphany earlier, but to use that same word again, that I had at the very end of those 3 years was, oh, I can communicate complicated and funny thoughts with simple Japanese. I don't have to use like really high level, difficult grammar and difficult words to express these funny ideas. I can do the same thing, but with simple grammar and simple words. I just have to choose the words correctly. And once that kind of clicked in my head, I was like, okay, I think I can do this. I took a year off from Japan. I went to Korea. I was kind of visa hopping between Korea and Japan for, I would say, like half a year. But I was trying to spend all my free time, again, doing the creative writing thing. And then when I got back to Japan as a juku teacher, like a cram school teacher, as I was doing that, that's when more and more people were like making the transition to full-time YouTubers. Like it was kind of the that was, let's see, like 2013, 2014. So it was kind of like when some people were finally starting to do YouTube as a job. And I looked at that and I was like, well, I'm making like a little bit of money off of these short stories that I've written in Japanese, but it seems like the general trend is going towards video. I wonder if I took all these scripts that I've written, like these short essays that I've written over the past like 3 or 4 years, what if I delivered these same exact scripts, but in video form? And that's kind of how I got started on YouTube. Like a lot of those, I want to say like the first, every other video for the first like 20 videos, it was one of those scripts that I had actually written like 5 or 6 years prior to when I actually uploaded it.
I'm about to go back and watch some of those early videos.
Yeah, go look at it now.
Yeah, so like the, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the supermarket video. Japanese supermarkets.
I know I've watched it. I can't remember fully the content. I've watched it though.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's that video. There's this video called Butter where I had this experience in high school where I was working at a concession stand in a movie theater, and this lady came in. She kept on asking for more and more butter on her popcorn, and I made like a short story out of that. But it was, I just delivered it in Japanese. But that's another example of like again. One of those early videos that I had written a long, long time prior to that, but it just got to the point where I was like, this would probably do better if it was in video form. And I had like the video editing experience from tricking because again, I was a backyard trickster. And the only way that we could get better was to record ourselves. And what everyone did is they would edit the videos and make these things called like samplers, kind of like demo reels, where you do like a bunch of moves like back to back and edit it all together with like cool music. So I kind of knew the basics of video editing. And it was kind of this weird instance of like all the, what do you say, the stars aligning, so to speak. It was like all these skills that I picked up over the years.
All came together.
Yeah, they all came together. And yeah, that's how I got to kind of the point that I am today.
I just have to say the very first video I ever watched on YouTube, the very first year it came out, was a martial arts tricking video.
Really?
It was called Kung Fu Tricks. I don't know why I remember that, but it was like this website is amazing.
And yeah.
I never stopped using it from there. So I know exactly what you were talking about when you say it.
That started your YouTube rabbit hole?
Yeah, started my YouTube rabbit hole for sure.
It's so interesting because, again, for the backyard tricksters, the only way we could get better was to record ourselves. Mm-hmm. But that was before YouTube was a thing. Mm-hmm. So what we actually did was we would like pool money together and host our videos on like a website that one of the tricksters owned. So when YouTube came out and anyone could upload any video, every trickster immediately got on board because we were like, oh, we've been waiting for this for so long.
Yeah, you know, so that totally correlates with like my memory because I feel like in those early days, it was my content was just flooded with martial arts tricking videos.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and that, exactly.
Between
exactly.
That and Daily Motion, it was like hopping back and forth between those to watch martial arts tricking videos. And the furthest I ever got was watching Ninja Warrior and trying to recreate and do that in the backyard.
Feel you there.
Yeah. Makoto Nagano, that guy, man. He was a legend.
I had a question about the critics that you would, or not critics, but people who would critique your work in Japanese.
Yeah.
Like how transparent were they? Were they like, this is actually trash? Or was it like, you know, not that it was, but I'm saying, like, would they actually tell you that? Or would they be very passive aggressive, you know, roundabout about it?
So you're talking about not the feedback that I got from my professors in university, but...
No. Like the website that you would submit your work to. Yeah.
Nine times out of 10, what would happen is they would only correct the grammar and or the word choice, so to speak, because that's what the website was meant for.
Oh, okay.
So I think that probably, even if it wasn't me interacting with Japanese people, I don't know. Certainly there are many differences in culture when it comes to how outspoken people are. But I can't imagine that it would be too much different, even if it was, you know, like someone from Argentina trying to learn French or something like that in a similar situation. But
I was just kind of curious because I know sometimes, like, when you ask for feedback, a lot of people are a little hesitant, you know, like, oh, yeah, you're good, Joseph, you know, like, it's great. So, I didn't know how, I guess, because it is a paid website or is it a volunteer?
They had paid options as well.
Okay.
Yeah. But
that's cool.
This probably answers your question better. But the people on that website would never critique me. But what would happen is, in that sense, they would never give me, like, feedback on my creative writing, just the grammar and, again, the word choice, like the vocab and that kind of thing. But then what would happen is once I got all the corrections and I started to implement the ones that I liked and maybe ignore the ones that I didn't like and refine the script a little bit, then I took that finished product, I don't know if that's the right word, finished script, and I would send it off to another person and ask for that advice specifically.
Oh, okay.
And when I did that, it was funny because I had this story that I was really, really confident in. I thought it was, like, so interesting and so, again, like, mind-blowing and cool. And I sent it off to this guy that I met. He was studying abroad at my university after I got back to university. So he came from Tokyo University to the University of Washington on study abroad. And I met him when he was studying abroad there. But he was... again, at the Tokyo University, like, Bungakubu literature department. So he knew his stuff. He was an extremely well-read person, unlike me. And so when I did send him this thing that I was pretty confident in, I literally said to him, like, I'm really confident in this. I think this is really good. So feel free to give me, like, don't hold back on your feedback. And what he did is he sent me, like, this, like, 5 or 6 page, oh, wow, like, critique that was, like, the basic message, again, was you're trying way too hard. But then what happened was the same exact thing that happened during university is I sent him another thing that I wrote. It was like, again, that was kind of a proper short story that I want to say was around like 40 or 50 pages, if not more. But then I sent him like this 2-page short essay that I wrote about like just me observing people in a Japanese Starbucks. And he was like, this one is good, though. And it's actually, like, funny. Like, I actually laughed when I was reading this. So, again, if you want to pursue writing, you probably want to, like, lean into this genre rather than this. And that was, like, the 4th or 5th time at that point that someone had said that to me. So I was like, fine.
Nope. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So just kind of... again, I took that advice and I tried to run with it.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And you did. Yeah. You sure did.
Well, it was so weird to me, though, because comedy was the last thing that I ever thought that I'd be good at. I was never the funny person in school or in like my class or anything like that. And so when people started telling me, like, I didn't even think the things that I had written were that funny. It was just kind of like, what would you say, like, you know, typing in like, you know, that's kind of, then I would put it in the script and people would be like, oh, that's good. And I was like, wait, really? That particularly like the big turning point I want to say was that supermarket video that the name of the script is I Like Japan, But.
Yeah.
And like the first like 4 or 5 lines in the video is like, I love Japan. I like Japan's deep or rich history, full of interesting characters. I like Japanese music. I love Japanese martial arts. But there's one part about Japan that I can't stand. The supermarkets. And then it was like a, again, maybe like a two-page thing from there that was just about what it felt like from my perspective as kind of someone who doesn't do too well in very crowded spaces, crowded and loud spaces, what it felt like going to a Japanese supermarket. But I wrote that basically like, I went to the supermarket and I came back and I felt so frustrated and so like, oh, like, why are the supermarkets like this? And I got back to my apartment and I wrote it in like, I don't know, 45 minutes, like an hour or something like that. And then I just uploaded it immediately after that. And again, like this was maybe like, I don't know, a couple months after I got that scathing feedback from my friend. But then it was all the complete reverse. It was like all these people on Language 8 that had normally only talked about my grammar suddenly saying, this is hysterical. Like, this is really funny. Like, this is the most I've laughed in weeks or something like that. And I was like, really? I almost couldn't believe it. It was just, again, something that I kind of wrote on a whim, but it seemed to work out. So that's yeah, what I ended up going with.
Sounds like it was the most authentic you, you know, and it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the best way to say it. I agree 100% because, again, when the feedback that I kept on getting was you're trying too hard, and I certainly was in retrospect. I had read like this story by Kanehara Hitomi, a fantastic writer, and I tried to copy her. And then like in my, what would you say, haste to become a great writer, I then tried reading like, you know, different works from like all the famous Japanese authors and a few famous American authors. I tried to play catch up, so to speak. So I read some books by like Mishima Yukio. I read The Old Man and the Sea, you know, kind of like classics, so to speak. I was trying to play catch up again. And then I tried to emulate that, but I'm not a literary genius like those people are. So when I tried to emulate it, it always backfired. So Nigel, what you just said, I think is 100% accurate. When I wasn't trying to do that and I just kind of relaxed a little bit and allowed myself to write in a much more, again, relaxed manner, it came off in a much more authentic and less forced manner. And that's what probably helped the most.
Yeah. Well, and then here you are, that, you know, that content, that those scripts, you know, you turned it into becoming like a like super well-known YouTuber with all these comedy scripts. And then, yeah, you know, and on top of that, like language, like educational videos too, you know, and you give it a good spin because you do add some of that comedy into some of your,
yeah, I tried
like language learning things. That's actually how I found your videos. I forget what year it was, but I was like looking, I'm like, oh man, this is great. Cause I could relate. I had just gotten back from a trip from Japan.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I was visiting my in-laws and just gotten back and I was jet lagged up at like 3 a.m. Just, I was like, something popped up on YouTube or Twitter. I don't know. I think it was Twitter. And then I clicked it and I was like, oh man, this is great. And then I went to YouTube to find the rest of
them. So I appreciate it.
Went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. I remember I would always watch your videos because I was just interested in kind of like your comedy in the sense of almost like teaching Japanese culture through your comedy. And I'm really into Japanese culture. So I was like, oh, you know, I really like his opinions. I really like, you know, how he describes things. Yeah, I thought that, you know, not only were you kind of educational in the language aspect, but also in the Japanese culture aspect.
I appreciate that. That's something that I try to actually be fairly conscious of. And what I mean by that is, Doug, I'm sure that, were you on the JET program, you said?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And Jennifer and Nigel, have you lived in Japan for an extended period of time at all, or just visits?
I've done study abroad and then constantly visited, and now I work where they bring me to Japan. So.
Oh, cool. Okay.
I've studied abroad on the same program that Jennifer did. We went to the same university.
Oh,
we studied
cool.
abroad at different times, but we both did.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. Yeah. Well, what I was going to say is oftentimes what happens when you're a foreigner living in Japan is you get that kind of euphoric initial Spike, I'm finally in Japan. Everything is amazing. But then once you start to kind of come back down to reality, it really depends on everyone's personal situation. But like as a JET program teacher, that's what I did. I did that for 3 years. I came to the realization that I was interested in Japan and not interested in teaching English. And I tried to be the best English teacher that I could, yeah. But it got to a point where, again, it was really starting to drain on me because the overwhelming majority of time that I spent awake each day, despite the fact that I was living in Japan, I spent that doing something that I wasn't passionate about. And I'm not sure the best way to kind of label that term, maybe just like foreigner in Japan drain. I'm not sure. But I find that happens to a lot of people, myself certainly included. And I've seen myself and other people as well. Certainly, I try and speak from my own experiences as much as possible, but it can get to a point where you start to become pessimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And when I make fun of various things in my videos, if I do make fun of something about Japan and Japanese culture, first of all, I try and do it, again, I try and make fun of it. I try and do it in a joke rather than just saying it in an angry tone and in a pessimistic way, because I want the Japanese viewers to be able to laugh as well. But then at the same time, if I do that and I try and hit on like a serious thing, then whether it's within that same video or the next video, then I try and bounce back and either make fun of those pessimistic foreigners and or things that are equally strange in, what would you say, as a foreigner living in Japan, looking at the culture in the States.
Yeah.
So I try and make fun of everyone rather than just Japan.
Yeah,
no, so
you got to do it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. I agree.
And I know exactly what you're talking about the pessimistic, like the swirl, I guess, is kind of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
After a few years, I had some former JETs that I was in Fukushima with that, you know, you could see it after maybe a year or two. I would see it a little in my, I stayed for 3 years as well. And I kind of see it starting to happen towards the end of my second year. And that's when I decided, you know, I think the third year, that's it. Because I don't want to be one of those ones that's just miserable, that stuck it out 1 year too long and have like a bad experience stamp, like a really overall, like an amazing experience, you know, like the last year kind of dampen it. So I totally get that. And yeah, it's it's real.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting though, being a little bit older now, to watch other people, whether it's local JETs here where I live, and or students at like the university that I used to work at, APU, or just, you know, other people on YouTube or Twitter that are going through those various phases. Because, I mean, you can really see it oftentimes. You can see the people that just got here and they're super excited. And then there's the people that are a little bit more pessimistic. And then there's people that have kind of, what would you say, like
a salary man in Tokyo for 10 years and they ride the train every day.
Yeah.
Just soulless creature, just slogging it through.
And then there's people that, I don't want to say people like me, but then there's people that have kind of been able to luckily get through that and stay in Japan. And when I see the people that are having a little bit of difficulty, I try and, you know, give a little bit of encouragement, like it gets better, you know?
Yeah.
And I do think that the main thing that kind of gets people into that pessimistic mindset is they often, again, just speaking from my own personal experience, it often takes too long to realize that what you're doing in Japan isn't what you want to actually do. And I find, and this is very difficult, of course, it's not an easy thing for everyone to do, but I find that the best way to have a long, fulfilling life in Japan is naturally to, if you can, get a job, find a career path that is actually more something that you like and then do that in Japan. I tell people, what would your dream job be if you could never come to Japan? Then people kind of think about it for a second, like, well, I'm into cosplay. I don't know, maybe if I could become a cosplayer or something like that, even if I couldn't go to Japan, that would be cool. Then I say, okay, then do that in Japan. Don't become an English teacher. If you do become an English teacher, use that as a stepping stone for that next thing.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, if you want to be a translator, that's a great option as well. But think about what you want to do rather than just getting to Japan.
Yeah. No, that's so true. So true. Before we switch over to the Japanese language, like, based questions that we had for you, I did have one last thing for regarding your YouTube. Did you think when you started uploading these videos that they would take off like they did? Like, at what point did you realize, wow, I actually, like, I need to start really, like, leveraging this? And because you said you decided to monetize at some point.
Yes.
You know, that was your kind of you shifting over once you noticed people starting to monetize. What I'm trying to get at is that, like, at what point, like, how, when did that click for you? Like, you're like, oh, these videos are taking off. Was it, you know,
I hope this doesn't come across as conceited.
No,
but
no.
When I did start uploading videos to YouTube, I was at a point where this was like 3 or 4 years after I had gotten that scathing advice from my friends that were well-read and well-educated and knew what they were talking about. And from that point, I did spend, again, like a solid 3 or 4 years trying to lean into the comedy. So by the time that I started uploading to YouTube, I felt that even if I wasn't a great writer, I felt that I at least knew what I was doing. And in that sense, I felt that even if these first videos don't get a ton of views, I feel like they're good. I'm confident in these videos. And oftentimes the scripts that ended up getting the most views were not those earlier scripts that I had written, but like these other kind of more punchy YouTube style videos, kind of like the, not like a long script that's a proper story, but like a shorter 2-minute video that has like, I don't know, 3 or 4 different jokes about learning Japanese in it. Kind of like what a train announcement sounds like in a textbook CD versus what it sounds like in real life. Those videos did quite well. And then what would happen is people would watch those videos and then come over to the other videos and they would say, oh, like this is my perception of things. They would say, like, these other videos, you know, they're very YouTube-esque, so to speak. Like, they're really meme-y, so to speak. But then these other videos, like the supermarket videos, this is more along the lines of, well, it's closer to, like, the image that I had was Bakugo, like, sit-down Japanese comedy. I wanted to try and do that, but on YouTube, so to speak, with cuts, try and make it a little bit more snappy, but I much prefer doing the scripts that kind of have a story and like dialogue rather than just, I quite like one line scripts as well, but I feel like there's a certain limit to the amount of like jokes that you can make out of this is what it's like in the classroom, but this is what it's like in real life. But once the videos did start to get some momentum, what happened is I woke up one day and I had like 1,000 more subscribers than the previous day. And at this point, I only had like 5,000 subscribers total. So it was a massive jump. And I was like, what's going on? So I went over to Twitter. And I said, saw a big bump in subs. Does anyone know what's going on? And this was at a point where I had like 500, 600, maybe 1,000 followers on Twitter. And they said, someone shared one of your videos in the Learn Japanese Reddit. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went over there and it actually was that video, like the train announcements, what it's like in the classroom versus like what it's like in real life. And I just basically said, hey, I wrote this. I'm the creator of this video. If you guys have any questions, feel free to leave a message below. And I want to say like 2 or 3 of the people were like, I would love to support you some way. Do you have like a Patreon? And I didn't know what a Patreon was at that point. I did a little bit of research and I was like, okay, maybe I'll try and do this. But While it would be great to make it with just the comedic content, I did feel like at that point, because again, I only had like, I don't know, 5,000 subs, unless I'm providing like a proper service or product, I don't think that there's probably going to be enough people that jump on board in order for me to quit my day job and pursue this full time. So I made the decision to teach Japanese pitch accent on Patreon, such that, again, it wasn't just, hey, if you want to support me, give me money. and kind of more like, hey, if you want to support me, this is a product that is hopefully helpful for you and your Japanese studies as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's a more of a win-win situation for everyone. And I was very, very fortunate to just see that the number of people that continued to subscribe on YouTube grew. And then the same, they were both linear, but at very different numbers. So like if I saw like maybe arbitrary number, 100 new like subs on YouTube in a week, then typically like one or two people would come over to Patreon as well. And so after, I guess, two and a half years, maybe three years of continuing to upload every day and continuing to make the pitch accent lessons, it got to a point where my Patreon income surpassed my APU day job income. And that was actually when my kids were born. So I took the parental leave.
Nice.
And well, I tried to concentrate on YouTube. That didn't really work because I had kids now. But at the end of that parental leave, when it was like time for me to go back to APU, I made the decision to not do that and to just continue doing just YouTube. And that's kind of where I am today. That was about a year and a half ago at this point.
And it's awesome when you find something, like you said, a passion that you can really dig into. And if you can monetize it in some way that you enjoy doing what you're doing, and hey, it's making you money on the side, not even on the side, but it's making you money, period.
Yeah.
It's your source of income now. That's fantastic. It's great. And, but yeah, no, that's so cool. Like there's some things I wish I could find a way to pivot to, you know, it's so awesome to hear. Hearing those success stories gives me hope that one day I can do that.
Yeah. I was in a very fortunate situation.
And that's it for part one of this two-part episode series featuring our conversations with Dogen. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, because I really did, and I know the rest of the crew did as well. On part two, we take a deeper dive into the Japanese language, specifically pitch accent language study. If you're interested in pitch accent language study, or just language study in general, you'll definitely find some benefit into listening to next week's episode, so please tune on in. Have you started studying pitch accent already? Or maybe you have a similar experience to Dogen? Feel free to share that with us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. No, not yet. Sorry, just getting there. But we're on those other ones, and you know where to find us. And if you don't, I'm going to spell it out for you. Don't worry. That's on Twitter at KREWEOFJAPAN, at Crew of Japan. And on Instagram at KREWEOFJAPANPODCAST, at Crew of Japan Podcast. Facebook, just search as Crew of Japan. You'll find us there. Give us a like. We're trying to build up that platform as well. So that's it for today. I hope you really enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next week for part two of our interview with Dogen.